Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. As summer approaches, many schools across Massachusetts are winding down their sports programs for the season. But for many kids, that doesn't mean they'll stop playing. They'll go to training camps, sign up with private coaches and elite summer leagues.
And many kids beg for these extra programs. But often, it's the parents trying to give their kids that extra edge who are pushing them. After all, it's never too soon to start thinking about that college scholarship or ticket to the pros, even for six-year-olds.
So this is what we're talking about. Here's a scene from the TV show Friday Night Lights in which the parent of a freshman quarterback pulls his son aside during halftime until the coach steps in.
What the hell are you doing out there? Where is your timing? We worked on this all week.
Sorry.
You look at me when I'm talking to you. You get your head in this game.
Joe,
right
I need
now.
My quarterback. What you doing?
What am I doing? I'm talking to my son. Is that a problem?
You yelling at him is not going to help anyone.
That is a family matter, Coach.
Well,
the way I talk to
him. I'm trying to get into your family matters, Joe. But I'll ask you to give kids some breathing room so I can work with them. How's that?
Well, it's a long way from the spontaneous, unsupervised ball games that used to crop up on America's streets every evening and weekend throughout the summer. And Jay Atkinson says it's one of the ways that parents are ruining youth sports.
Atkinson runs the Methuen Fun Hockey League, and he wrote a piece recently for the Boston Globe about what's wrong with youth sports today. Too much money, too much parent involvement, and too many broken-hearted six-year-olds. Not to mention too many well-meaning adults who have no clue about all of the above. And Jay Atkinson joins us now. Welcome to the program. Thanks for writing the piece and thanks for coming in.
Yeah, it's the 800 words that shook the sports world.
There we go. Well, listeners, did you feel shaken up by Jay Atkinson's piece? We're going to talk about what he said in a moment. If you didn't read it, you can find it at radioboston.org. But here's the question. When it comes to youth sports, have we lost the plot? Are we pushing our kids too hard to compete rather than encouraging them to get outside and just have some fun? Give us a call with your experience, your question, your comments. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Jay, first of all, tell me what you're seeing out there. You write that 45 million American kids, that's at least one kid from three out of four American families, are playing organized sports, but you say there's a big gap between a child's desire to have fun and adult expectations. So what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if this is, if we use the parallel or the metaphor of climate change, if we're talking about climate change in youth sports, it's 1965 and we can still do something about it. Mm-hmm. We can still take the model that's been evolving over the last few years and change it and reduce the number of greenhouse athletic gases and go backwards in time.
So what are those greenhouse athletic gases? What's the problem?
Yeah, I mean, the three things that I talked about in the piece are single sport specialization, where a child is encouraged, some germ of some kind of talent is seen by someone at age six or seven, and their parents get convinced to have them play hockey or do hockey dry land training or go to hockey schools year-round, to the detriment of just being a kid, riding their bike and playing wiffle ball and things like that. So that has physical ramifications for the child, because if they're doing repetitive motion while they're still growing over and over again, whether it's the skating motion or the throwing motion for a baseball player, they're damaging their joints. Mm-hmm. Psychologically, it's bad for the child because it's removing the marvel of playing the sport and making it into a routine or a job that is psychologically going to be damaging to the child, because eventually they're going to get sick of it. So that was point one. Point two was the privatization of youth sports. And in the piece, I use this anecdote about this so-called Tier 1 elite program. I was invited to come and speak at their banquet. And those families were paying, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 to play ice hockey, to try out for the team. So that meant 5 and 6-year-olds were trying out for positions, and they had 100 kids try out for 18 positions, which meant, you know, quite a number of kids went home unhappy. Then in these private leagues where they're paying so much money, sometimes they're leaving places like the Merrimack Valley, where hockey is quite good, or Metro Boston, where hockey is quite good, and they're traveling to Pennsylvania, and they're traveling to Maryland.
Huge pressure on the families to make this possible, right?
To play hockey in a lesser hockey area, just so they will buy the track suits that the team requires you to buy, the bags that the team requires you to buy, underwrite the bus trips, pay the coaches, and so forth. So when we were kids, the Little League coach, the hockey coach, they were volunteers. They were people that just wanted the kids to get out there and learn something about the sport and make friends.
Well, let me sort of throw this idea at you. What's wrong with, I mean, I understand this all sounds absurd, you know, sending kids down to Pennsylvania and thousands of dollars and all that, but what's wrong with pushing kids to play hard, to compete? Is there value in that? Or have we gone overboard with that as well?
Well, I think there's value to pushing kids hard to compete when they reach high school. So I think prior to high school, and a lot of studies bear this out, that if you have your child involved in an array of activities, so when ice hockey finishes in April, they put away their skates and they go out to the lacrosse field, or they go out to the soccer field. So they're moving from the sheet of ice to grass.
Right.
And then in the fall, they may play in a fall basketball league, so they're going to a hardwood floor from grass. So they're alternating the surface and the skills that they need to play these sports, but they're still working on their balance, their timing, their conditioning, and they're meeting kids from different walks of life in the different sports.
Yeah, and you also talk about, and you bemoan sort of the loss of sports as an opportunity for unsupervised play, after-school pickup games, spontaneous play that attracts everyone in the neighborhood. What do we lose when we give that up?
Well, I think one of the things, and I've been thinking about and writing about this issue for quite a while. So yeah. I actually did my undergraduate thesis in philosophy on the interiority of the sports experience,
yeah.
The peak moments that you see in sports that give you a deeper sense of reality. The only people that can share that reality are the other people that participated in the event with you. That's why children, even at a young age, 6 and 7, 8 years old, they really bond with each other because they were both there when that key hit. Mm-hmm. Happened in the Little League game. The parent is necessarily outside that experience, but the parent is trying to insert him or herself in between the two peers that participated in that experience, and that's a mistake.
I see.
When we were kids, my dad saw me play hockey when I played for the high school team. That's it. He never went and watched me skate on the pond. He was too busy putting a roof over our heads.
It's funny you mentioned that. I remember playing Little League. My parents never came out. I never thought of them as neglectful. They were just doing other things, and I was into Little League. So
right.
It's interesting. That's completely changed now, isn't it?
It is. It is. And, you know, I'm reminded when I think of when people ask me to relate horror stories from youth sports, I'm reminded of Hemingway's remark that if you've shot one bird flying, you've shot all birds flying. Because just yesterday I was at my nephew's ball game, Little League game. My brother is an assistant coach on his other son's team, and he told me that the day before, his team that he's assistant coach on has a really overzealous sports dad as the head coach,
yeah.
Which puts my brother in an uncomfortable position because his son just wants to play for fun. And they're like the New York Yankees of this Little League. They're undefeated.
Mm.
So they played a team the other day. The team caught up to them. And in the last inning, they had a couple runners on base. And they got a little infield bleeder. And the player came home to score what looked like the winning run. But he never actually touched home plate. Because all the kids mobbed them to celebrate beating the evil empire, the Yankees team, my brother's team, right? The umpire is a 15-year-old kid, and he's been trained. You don't signal that the game is over until either the kid is out or he touches home plate. So the overzealous sports dad notices that the umpire is still looking down at the plate while the other team is celebrating and leaving the field. So the overzealous sports dad yells out to his son, the shortstop, go out to the parking lot and tag him out.
Oh, come on.
The kid left the field, tagged him, and the umpire saw it, and he reluctantly
signaled out.
It gets worse.
Oh, my God.
The coach goes into the middle of the diamond and performs like a matador's coup de grace, like, yeah! And my brother just looked at his son and said, let's go home.
Oh, boy. So, Jay, you advocate returning youth sports to the neighborhood. And to that end, tell me what led you to create the Methuen Fun Hockey League. How is it different from the typical youth sports league?
Well, we a good friend of mine, another hockey dad, his name is Mark Donahue. He's a police detective up in Salem, New Hampshire. He and I, our kids were 5 and 6 years old, and they were in youth hockey. And immediately they were asked to try out for MITE teams and be seated and put on travel teams. So it started 13 years ago was our first incarnation of the Methuen Fun Hockey League, where we said, gee, Methuen High, unlike most high schools in the state, has a rink in the school. We don't have to travel anywhere. We have some of the most interested hockey fanatic kids in the whole state living right here. So let's start an in-house program. Let's keep it cheap. Let's focus on teaching them skating, because ice skating is a lifelong talent, like riding a bicycle. You see 70, 80-year-old guys skating at public skating, mm-hmm. because it's something that the kid can use forever. Let's focus on that. Let's give them shirts that just say Methuen Fun Hockey League. Let's keep the price, and we've kept it under $100. For 13 years, for 22 hours of instruction, a jersey, a team party, a hat.
Can anyone play?
And we take anybody between the ages of 4 and 15. And then we have teenage players as like mentors and assistant coaches underneath the volunteer adults that supervise.
What about 50-something radio hosts? I want to come out and play.
You can come out.
Okay, good.
Joseph Kahn wrote a feature about us in The Globe a couple months ago. And he wanted to go out there.
It sounds great. Listeners, there it is. We're talking to Jay Atkinson. He wrote a piece in the Boston Globe magazine earlier this month entitled How Parents Are You Ruining Youth Sports. It's gotten a lot of reaction. We're talking about it now. Join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And we've already got some listeners who want to join the conversation. But first, let me introduce Dan Lebowitz. He's executive director of the Center for Sport and Society at Northeastern. He also coaches his sons in youth basketball in Natick. And Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And now you've got five boys, all of whom have been involved in youth sports. Do you share some of the concerns that you're hearing Jay talk about here?
Actually, I wanted to applaud Jay for the piece because I'm actually one of those reformed dads. So I think that, you know,
when you say reformed dads, you used to be, what, a little too excited about,
I would
a little
say
too involved?
Overzealous in terms of engaging in the sport, in terms of losing sight of what it meant to be someone that was leading positive youth development. What does positive youth development look like? What does that framework look like for kids? What is their ability to sort of process information and not see it as negative? And so when I read Jay's piece, I was very touched on a lot of levels. Sort of the evolution of becoming the executive director of Sport and Society, where we look at these issues all the time, but sort of the evolution of a dad in terms of the framework of what you put your kids up against in that backdrop.
Well, then talk to us as a former sort of overzealous dad. What leads parents to sort of get into that situation, that difficult dynamic where we heard an example from Friday Night Lights where they're just too involved and it's almost like there's too much at stake, in terms of their kids' performance out there?
I think a lot of it has to do with sort of the vicarious living through your child in many respects. I mean, if you were a high school athlete and you remember that as a positive time or a positive bonding time, but maybe you've sort of over-exaggerated the successes of your own life or what they meant or what life lessons you learned, you can sort of try to impart that on an unsuspecting kid that did just go out there to learn the sport, play the sport, and sort of learn that whole beauty of what cooperative spirit means. And yet we're in this conundrum of what youth sport looks like, because on one hand you have the whole concept of cooperative spirit that's probably enveloped through the entirety of Jay's program. On the other hand, you have sort of the competitive structure of the world we live in. And so it's that push-pull of what does a positive youth sport coaching look like? What does that model look like? What is, how do we start looking at coaches in the same way we look at classroom teachers? What qualifies them? What would they have in a lesson plan? Hmm. What would the takeaways be for a kid? What is, certain places in the city, for instance, there's a place called Doc Wayne Basketball. They look at certain elements of sport in terms of it has to be trauma-informed, because the developmental mind of a kid, there's just a lot of trauma in the developmental mind of a kid, whether it's a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old, and beyond. So I think when we talk about this, we have to first start thinking about what is the developmental mind of a young child look like, and how does sport be a positive influence in that dynamic?
Jay, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. And I think when I look at the 45 million kids that are playing youth sports, I see not a problem but an enormous opportunity for us. Because as a writer and as an educator and as a coach, I have limited time. So what I thought was, I think there's been a drop-off in recreational athleticism and cooperative events like what Dan's talking about. And there's also been a drop-off, and there was a piece on your station earlier today, in recreational reading for teenagers. Mm-hmm. So why not connect recreational ice hockey and floor hockey with recreational reading and make it all one curriculum? So I have the coaching license from MIAA, Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association. I have a coaching license from USA Hockey. So in partnership with the Bruins Foundation, we've created the Skate and Read, which is part of the Fun Hockey League. So in the cycle that just ended, we had 41 kids between the ages of 4 and 14 read in aggregate 401 age-appropriate books from our list that was developed by educators. So here's a potential model for learn to play lacrosse, learn to play basketball, learn to play baseball.
It sounds great. I want to just ask you about how parents resist this pressure, and I'll tell a personal story. So I have a daughter. She's in 11th grade. She's a varsity soccer player. She's pretty good. I don't think she's going to, you know, be playing professional soccer, but she's good. And she is getting a lot of pressure from the college counselor, for example, saying she needs to go to camps during the summer. You know, she's got to, if she wants to sort of push this and add to her overall package of skills to present to the colleges, go to camp, go to this, do extra leagues, do, you know, she plays on two different teams. It all strikes me as too much, but I'm not exactly sure as a parent how I resist it.
Yeah, Dan, go ahead.
I think that's a hard question. So, you know, I talk about being sort of that reformed parent, yet because I have so many boys, I've got the question from one of those boys, why didn't I push him as hard as I did the other one?
And
because I think kids are also caught up in this whole groundswell. The groundswell is with the advent of year-round sport, with specialization, with the fact that Real Madrid signed a 7-year-old a couple of years ago to a multi-million dollar contract, with the advent of places like Street and Smith magazine, which can tell you who the best third and fourth grader is in the country, there is a dynamic even among the kids about excellence and how excellence is achieved. And so, you know, we're in a what we need to do is sort of create a larger conversation like we would again in that classroom with the kids involved, with parents involved, with the youth leaders involved in terms of what does it look like? How do we, you know, we have a Pandora's box that's opened. How do we start to close it a little bit to move much more towards sanity
in our realm? Well, there's the question, listeners, 800-423-8255. And let's take a couple of calls right now. Mike is calling from Framingham. Hi, Mike. You're on the air with Jay Atkinson and Dan Lebowitz.
Hi, guys. Thanks for letting me talk. Boy, can I relate to this situation. I'm telling you what, I had a son who played hockey, and he was a great player. He was one of those kids could stick handle through everybody, scored all the goals when he was in beginners and peewees and mites and all that. And it got so bad, I put so much pressure on him as time went on, that it got to be to the point where he was afraid to make a mistake. I would yell at him from the bleachers, you know, move your feet. What I did was I drew attention to him. And he got to the point to where he literally was afraid to make a mistake, and he pulled himself off the ice. You know, most kids get on the ice and they don't want to leave. The coach has to get them off the ice. My son would look for the first chance to bail on the ice. He was afraid to try a slap shot for fear he would whiff. And no matter how I tried to tell him, look, they'll forget that in 5 minutes everybody will forget you missed. But I put so much pressure on this young man that it took the fun out of him, and he was afraid to let go and just be himself. Hockey's one of those sports, in my opinion, you can't think too hard about it. It has to just be a natural, it just has to flow out of you, and I took that from him. I was one of those overzealous parents who yelled. I got kicked out of the league. I was ended up sneaking into rinks because I was not allowed to come watch my own son play hockey. I had to put on caps, glasses, go hide in the corner, and if I couldn't pull that off, some rinks had windows. I'd be standing at the door looking through the window with snow coming down on me.
Watching my son
play hockey.
Mike, I'm really, really grateful for your call, and you give voice to exactly what we're talking about, overzealous parents, and good for you for sort of coming to terms with this. I want to move on and just get a couple of other perspectives, but Mike, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Jean, who's calling from Brookline.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. This is a really interesting topic, and I totally, totally agree with what you're saying. One thing I noticed, though, my children are long out of sports. So this happened a long time ago. My eldest is 30, my youngest is 25. But one thing I noticed about recreation leagues, you know, we did that with our kids. And I noticed that the quality of play wasn't very good, and the coaches were wonderful volunteers, but the kids, a lot of the kids had been drawn off into these traveling leagues, and the only place where competition was good, where you really got those peak experiences because everybody was really trying hard all the time, was the recreational, was the traveling teams, and not these recreational leagues.
Right.
So the trick is, when we open this conversation, you have to find a way to make this sort of level, this peak experience that you want kids to have, come to everybody.
No, it's a great point, Gene, and let me put that to Jay. Jay, Gene's point there that non-competitive leagues might be, uncompetitive, boring for kids.
Yeah, but I think if you draw a lot of those kids back from the travel leagues and make your youth hockey grow again from 200 kids back to the 600 that it had, say, 15 years ago, you'll have a whole top layer of kids playing in the house league where it's competitive. Mm. And that's what my friends and I did. We played in those top level of the house leagues, and then I played college sports and high school sports. So I don't think it's necessarily a one or the other type of thing. Mm. And just to touch briefly on the other caller's point, good for him for being so self-aware, but it reminds me, and this is something Dan and I were speaking about at length before the program, that the coach's job is in loco parentis. Like, the coach's job is to legislate out some of that pressure. And if you go and you get some training as a coach at the MIAA, at USA Hockey, at USA Soccer, you can act in that role where you can learn how to legislate out some of the parents' pressure on the child and let the child participate within his peer group without that kind of pressure.
Boy, that's a tough role, though, Dan. I'm wondering, you know, when we heard that parent call in and confessing that he was one of those overzealous parents, did you relate to that at all, Dan? But, and also, I want to ask you what Jay's talking about. That's a tough job for a coach to kind of take charge not only of the kid, but of the overzealous parent in the stand.
I think, you know, obviously I related to it because you never want to ruin the youth experience of any kid, particularly your own. I mean, you know, the bond of parenthood and the sort of the responsibility and love inherent in that is something that's really always a tough balance. I think that, you know, what Jay's talking about is figuring out a solution to the problem. You know, I talked about a Pandora's box being open and it's tough to close, and yet there are ways, if in a program as attractive as his, or, you know, at our center now, we're looking at how do we create a sort of a coaching certification? How do we have this conversation and move the world to a conversation around what does coaching certification look like? What does that positive model look like? What do those classrooms lessons look like on a field? How do we reduce trauma in that realm? And how do we sort of change the game? Because the game isn't just the emotional stress. As Jay pointed out earlier, when these kids are playing year-round sports, they never change movements. And so many of them tear up their knees or ruin their career before they even get started. And so the overzealous father or the overzealous parent that's trying to push their kid towards success might have actually ruined their body in the very sport they wanted to push them to.
Well, Jay, we literally have just 30 seconds left. I'd love to get a sort of closing thought from you. Any final advice to parents, I guess, who are working hard, who take to heart these issues you put on the table, but have kids who are committed to doing sports? What's the best way forward?
Well, let's look at the summer is approaching. So when you're trying to decide, when you get that urgent email from your son's youth hockey program asking your son to commit to the 8-week summer hockey program, look out the window at the blue sky and say, you know what? Let's go fishing.
Great advice. That's Jay Atkinson. He runs the Methuen Fun Hockey League Skate and Read program. He's the author of Memoirs of a Rugby Playing Man, Guts, Glory, and Blood in the World's Greatest Game. His piece in the Boston Globe magazine earlier this month was entitled How Parents Are Ruining Youth Sports. Jay, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And Dan Lebowitz, executive director of the Center for Sport and Society at Northeastern. He also coaches his sons in youth basketball in Natick. Thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, Teller on Making Magic in the ART's new production of The Tempest. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.